Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
Before us this evening, we have this question of evil, and as you may have noticed on your handout, we're talking about the emergence of evil. But notice that we're not talking about the emergence of evil as such. That's another story. We're talking about the emergence of evil as a theological problem. Now, notice that this is helpful to keep in mind because, as we have in the book of Genesis, and as you may have noticed in all sorts of other primordial creation narratives, I'm thinking of especially Greek mythology, but also some ancient Near Eastern cosmogonies. Enuma Elish comes to mind, where we have accounts or narratives concerning the first human beings on this earth and their relations with the gods. There is evil right there. But notice that evil, as we're going to consider it, is, and as you might have noticed on this handout, is a specifically Judeo-Christian problem, theological problem. So if we ask the question of whether or not non-Christians, people who've never heard the name of Jesus Christ, who've never had any contact with biblical religion, I'm talking about Christians, very largely speaking, or Jews, or even Muslims. I know that some of these questions are controverted, is the extent to which these three world religions constitute some sort of whole, but we won't talk about that now. Notice that if somebody such as a Hindu or a Buddhist has a beautiful new child that dies, we have no reason to expect that such a person will suffer any less than a Christian or a Jewish person. The evil is every bit as real, and it causes every bit as much sorrow. Whether we're talking about the death of a child or the death of any loved one or the harm that might come to a person in one of the accidents of life or anything of that sort. But notice that it probably will not create pose a theological problem for him. He will not, for all of that, be led away from his faith. But notice this is not at all uncommon for Christians to leave the church, however we're going to understand it, be it the Catholic Church or the church as understood by non-Catholic Christians. The death of a child or the death of any loved one or any horrific setback that might be part of anyone's life will not present a theological problem. Such a person will not normally be led to question the basic tenets of his religion, however we're going to understand it. And why might this be? Because for people of other religions, evil is simply baked into the nature of things. It's a reality. But it's not all that easy for a Christian especially to come to terms with this problem or this question of evil. Why do bad things happen to good people? Now, it's worth thinking about why this is problematic for Christians. The answer is right there on the handout. This would have to do with two largely biblical presuppositions or tenets of our faith, namely that God is perfectly good. God is incapable of willing evil to anyone. And so if God is all good and wants nothing but our good and has created us for nothing less than sharing his own goodness, his own happiness, then something like the death of a child can be problematic. Now notice that Christians also believe that God is omnipotent. In other words, he is all-powerful. He can do whatever he wants. Now, throughout the history of Christianity, there have been debates on
what this omnipotence might look like. If God is all powerful, why can't he build a rock or make a rock so big that he couldn't lift it? As you may have heard that question put to you in your sophomore dorm room. Now notice that that is really a silly question to ask. It involves a number of non sequiturs and a number of senseless presuppositions. But we'll leave that alone now. But if God is all powerful and all good, why is it that my beautiful baby daughter or baby son has died? Now, this might not seem to make much sense. Now, one of the things to keep in mind with respect to these creation narratives, non-Christian creation narratives, is that evil is generally baked into things for the simple reason that the gods, generally plural, have their own foibles. If the pantheon of gods of Greek and Roman antiquity come to mind, they should. Notice that they're vindictive, jealous, murderous, and all of that. They have all the failings that human beings do. And that's why they show up in human beings. Now, if you're thinking of Pandora, or if anybody here is thinking of Pandora, this is a myth that appears towards the middle of Hesiod's famous epic poem in the Theogony. And notice that here, after humans received the stolen gift of fire from Prometheus, Zeus, very angry guy, he's an angry Zeus, decides to send through an intermediary this Pandora. And there, as you may have noticed, if you've had any kind of acquaintance with Greek mythology, there are all sorts of ways of understanding her actions and what she did. We know now that it was not probably a box. It was probably more like a vase that she got mixed up with. And from that, she unleashed all sorts of evils on the world. But there, notice that even if we take that narrative at face value, she's not the first. Zeus is, at least, to say nothing of the evils in the other gods. Now, we're not going to go any further with Greek mythology. That's not why we're here. One of the things that does need to be mentioned, though, is the rather long list of attempts at resolving this tension between God's omnipotence and his benevolence, his perfect benevolence, which becomes particularly problematic when Christians come along. Now, the big name here is Gnosticism. It took many different forms over the centuries, but all the different forms and all the names you might see here on the handout, which is just a sampling of them, have generally a few major points in common. We have the first one is Marcion. He was active before the last ink had dried on some of the works of the New Testament, perhaps more. But anyway, Marcionism or Gnosticism lies in the background of a few of the books of the New Testament. They have Gnosticism in their sites. John's Gospel would be one such. Now, notice that a few of the common tenets here of the Gnostics is a radical bifurcation of reality into two realms, one good, spiritual, and well illuminated, and that would be the God of the New Testament. The other would be the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and all the prophets. And this would be the God who created the material world in which we're living and our bodies. So the spiritual world would show itself internally in our own being, in our souls. The material world, created by the God of the Old Testament, gave us our bodies. And notice that's where our suffering comes from, at least if we take it superficially. I don't think they were terribly preoccupied with spiritual suffering at the time. But notice we have two different worlds, one created by the God of the Old Testament, the bad God, and the spiritual world of light and peace and eternal happiness, which would correspond to the God of Jesus Christ. And notice that this involves two different revelations. We have the revelation of the Old Testament and the revelation of the New. And notice that this provides a very handy way of getting around this problem of God's perfect benevolence and his perfect goodness in coming to terms with evil. Now, Marcion's active until about the second half of the second century, but it was not more than a generation or so afterwards that another one came along, and this would be Valentinus. And he was more popular, or would appear to have had more influence, greater influence, more widespread influence, geographically speaking, than Valentinus. And he's active throughout much of the second century. And though there are significant differences between the two men, the two characters, and their two systems, they basically shared this radical duality or dualism, metaphysical dualism between two gods, one good, one bad, one material, the other spiritual, and this dualism, which is also anthropological. We're divided up into a spiritual being and a corporeal being, and the key to happiness is flight from the body and flight from this material world. If this sounds like some of the writings of Plato, it should, because Valentinus, as had been Marcion, were quite the Platonists. And then we have one of the guys who was perhaps more influential than his two predecessors, and that would be Manes, the guy who's responsible for giving us this sect that eventually came to be known as Manichaeism. Now notice that I use the word sect, but they were really much more than that. The Manichaeans, during the 3rd and 4th centuries, right up until the Middle Ages, and we can talk about maybe even the Middle Ages, up until about the 12th, 13th centuries, were a real force to be reckoned with in both the eastern section of the Mediterranean and the western one. That is to say, in both the Latin part of the Mediterranean world, known to Augustine, and also the Greek-speaking part of the Mediterranean, the eastern half, known to John Chrysostom. They represented a major or a very substantial block of these populations. Now, John Chrysostom had to deal with them. Augustine was himself a Manichaean for no fewer than 9 years before he converted to Christianity, which story is very well described and discussed in one of his more famous works, and that would be his Confessions. Now, notice that after the Manichaeans had, enjoyed their prime, this Gnosticism showed itself once again in the 10th century. We're talking about not the earliest Middle Ages, but getting towards the middle of the Middle Ages, by a guy by the name of Bogomil, who flourished in what is now known as Macedonia, and also in Serbia and Croatia, that part of the world we now call the Balkans. And they enjoyed considerable influence, which influence probably made its way to Western Europe in a group of, normally described as heretics, but we'll just call them a sect, and that would be the Cathars. One of the things that's striking here is the Cathars' doctrines or their worldview was remarkably similar to that of Marcion and Valentinus. So here we have almost, just about, a millennium. That would be a millennium between these two movements, the Marcionists and the Valentinians, and the Cathars, who were famous in France, southern France especially, during the late 12th and throughout the 13th centuries. Why this is relevant is that this habit I'm wearing and Father Irenaeus is wearing shows us to be Dominican friars. The Dominican movement was established precisely as a response to this way of thinking, this Gnosticism of the Cathars. Now, the Cathars passed into non-existence towards the end of the 13th century, a couple of decades after Thomas Aquinas' life. These points are disputable, debatable, but basically there are not many Cathars around these days. There are a few neo-Cathars hanging out in southern France, but not many of them. But it's worth keeping in mind that throughout much of the church's first millennium, and even well into its second millennium, Gnosticism was a real problem. And this because people wonder why bad things happen to good people, and why what there is with evil, what's the big deal, or why do we have to suffer with it? Now notice that the story doesn't end there. Throughout history, Christians have tried to address these problems, and they have occasionally confronted Gnosticism, generally speaking, some more capably than others. The one who is perhaps more influential than anybody else, not perhaps, very certainly more influential than anybody else, would be Augustine of Hippo, St. Augustine. Now, it's worth keeping in mind that, once again, he had spent 9 years as a Manichaean, so he knew something about which he was talking. Now, this guy, or excuse me, St. Augustine, is famous for having left us a few coherent replies to the objections of the Manichaeans, or the Gnostics more generally speaking. It occurred to him, basically when he became a Platonist, that there are kinds of being that are not corporeal, that incorporeal, that is to say spiritual, not to say divine, but spiritual, incorporeal beings exist. This made it much less difficult for him to understand passages in Scripture, such as the narrative in Genesis, where we find Adam seeing God walking through the garden, but he saw him from behind. How can God walk through a garden? This didn't make any sense to Augustine. But eventually, after his contact with the Platonists, these passages of Scripture which would describe God in anthropomorphic terms became less problematic. Now, we will hear more about this tomorrow, but notice that Augustine was able to talk about evil as something that could be attributed to a benevolent God, as long as we could make sense of the term permission. Now, we heard Father Irenaeus speak very capably about this just a few hours ago at Mass, but we noticed that God never intends evil directly. And it's worth keeping in mind why that might be. We'll see in a few moments Thomas Aquinas talking about this, because it's simply not possible for God or any other intelligent being, angelic or human, to intend evil. Evil, by definition, is that which is not desirable. It's not appetible. Nobody likes it. In other words, if you're having a cup of coffee, you're hoping it's going to be a good cup of coffee. If you're enjoying a chocolate chip cookie, you hope it's going to be a good one. And if you're listening to music, you hope it's going to be good, whether it's Led Zeppelin or Taylor Swift. Now, some people will find Taylor Swift absolutely abominable. And these people might just like Led Zeppelin. But notice, in either case, they want to listen to what strikes them as good, what is appetible to them. Now, people will argue over which of these might be good or which one might be bad. The Latins had a famous expression, de gustibus non est disputandum. And many people just take that as de gustibus now. That is to say, these are matters of taste, and they're not subject to debate. Nobody can settle rationally by rational argument whether Bud Light is better than Miller Light or Miller Light is better than Bud Light. I wouldn't give you a nickel for either. But the good is defined as that which is desirable. Now, notice that we are using the term good here analogically. If we're talking about a good meal or a good piece of music, we're talking about two different kinds of reality by the same descriptive, the same adjective here. Now, notice we can also talk about good people. Somebody might be good at tennis or good at golf or good at ice hockey. But notice that other people are just simply called good, simply speaking. That's because they're virtuous, most especially just. They're just people. And so we say that's a good woman or that's a good man. But notice that we're not speaking metaphorically when we call all of these realities good, because we're using this term good in a way in which a certain part of the meaning of the term good is salvageable in all of these usages. If we talk about this piece of pie being good, this glass of wine being good, this glass of wine not being good, or whatever, this music being good or not, this athletic performance or artistic performance being good or bad, we're talking about music or food or artistic performances as desirable. That's the common element of anything that can be called good. So if it's not desirable, it's not good. Now, by contrast, evil is that which is inherently not desirable. Whether we're listening to music or eating a chocolate chip cookie or having a glass of wine or looking at an artistic performance or hearing one, we want it to be desirable. And if it's bad, we don't want to hear it. Now, notice that this gives us some way of understanding how it is that bad things can happen to good people. Augustine basically says that God permits these bad things to happen. Why might he do that? To bring good out of it. In other words, the evil action, even as permitted, is never the direct object of his will. He cannot intend it. Now notice that in recent decades, maybe a generation or two, some theologians and other thinkers have pointed to the fact that the term permission can be misleading. As Augustine used the term, and as Aquinas and others in the Middle Ages used the term, it didn't mean anything like what we might call consent. In other words, if we could think of the case of an 8-year-old boy seeing rock climbers in a mountain area, climbing up a rock face, and he begs his father to let him do it. Let me do that, Dad. I can do that. And Dad says, you'll do it when you're a little older, not right now. You're going to have to grow up a little bit before you start climbing up rock faces. Now, notice that the kid is really, really persistent and sticks with his pleading long enough. He might just bend his father's will. But notice he's probably, even if his father says, okay, you can do it, but be really, really careful. At some level, the father is probably consenting to his son's climbing this rock face. As an example I've used in some of my classes, if we could use imagine a case where maybe a 16-year-old girl has a boyfriend with a brand new motorcycle, and she wants to ride on the back of it. And so she asks her dad if she can do this. And dad says, no, not a chance. Not going to happen. And she's really, really insistent. Maybe after a week or two, she bends her father's will. And dad says, okay, just this once. You can do it once, but be really careful. At some level, he's probably consented to his daughter's riding on the back of her boyfriend's motorcycle. But notice that such is not the case with God's engagement with evil. If something bad happens on God's watch, then that would be everything. It's not because God simply permits it. A better expression, or an expression put forward in recent generations, I think, is that God declines to prevent it. Now, this allows us for some way of understanding how it is that bad things happen to good people. Now, notice that if we move on from Augustine to one of Augustine's more astute readers in the Middle Ages, that would be one Thomas Aquinas, the aforementioned Aquinas. He and his contemporaries, and that would be the famous Franciscan Bonaventure and some of his Dominican contemporaries, William of Alton, they mentioned these Cathars, these medieval Gnostics, who probably had some sort of connections with the Manichaeans of old, who seem to have been connected with the Bogomils, with Bogomil, and the Bogomils seem to have been in the background of the emergence of these Cathars in France, then there would have been some direct connection between the Cathars known to Thomas Aquinas and the Manichaeans known to Augustine. That can't be documented, but it would appear to be probable. Now, one of the things that's interesting is, at least in the descriptions of them and their teachings, the Cathars known to Aquinas were remarkably similar to the Manichaeans of old. They subscribed to the same teachings. Basically, there's a God of the New Testament, the God of light, the spiritual God, and there's the God of the Old Testament who gave us the material world and our bodies. And notice that it's Aquinas who really draws out the implications of the understanding of goodness as he had found it in the writings of Aristotle, especially in his Nicomachean Ethics. Aristotle had said many, many centuries before, goodness is what everyone desires. And by implication, what's not good, what is evil, is what no one desires. It's what anyone finds repugnant, be it in food or music or whatever. Now, one of the questions that with which Thomas has to contend throughout his writings is whether or not there's something that could be described as a supreme evil being. Now, notice that Hollywood screenwriters would be out of luck if we were to show to everybody that no such being could possibly exist. But one of the ways in which Thomas describes God, or asks his thinkers, his readers, to think about God, is by describing him as the summum bonum, the sum of all goodness, the being in whom no kind of goodness, however understood, could ever be lacking. He's absolutely good. He's goodness itself, which is one of the reasons why nobody has to worry about getting kicked out of heaven after having had a bad day. It can't happen, for the simple reason that nothing is good outside of God, and confronted with this goodness, nobody is at liberty to turn away from it, because it's goodness that engages our wills. Now, so it's clear that after having described God as the summum bonum, he has to ask this question, whether or not there's a summum malum, not just because it's an interesting question philosophically or theologically, but because that's exactly what all of these generations, all of these different forms of Gnostics had claimed, that there's a summum malum, and that would be the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and all the prophets, the God who created the world and everything in it. And as we'll hear tomorrow, the answer is simply no, it can't happen. Why? Because evil as such doesn't exist. It's to the contrary, a privation or the absence of something that should exist, but in fact doesn't. Now, in other words, evil is always parasitic on some good. After that, he offers us a few basic distinctions for describing how it might be that we have different kinds of evil and different ways of thinking of evil. Notice, if you get behind the wheel of your car and you head west on Michigan Avenue, and you see that it's a wide open road with several lanes on going each way, and there's not much traffic, and so instinctively you might just step on the gas a little bit, and before you get to North Capitol Street, you're doing 45 miles an hour. And then you just take a little glance to your left, or your right, they're on both sides of the road, you will see a whole line of cameras right there ready to nab tourists, especially going to the shrine. And you will be stuck with a big ticket. And that would be something that you might consider evil. But notice that your violation of the speed limit has been inadvertent. It has not been intentional. And so without intention, it's really not easy to make a case that you're driving 45 on Michigan Avenue is evil. Might be careless, but not really evil. But you might perceive that fine as evil. That's what we would call the evil of punishment. Malum poene, the evil of punishment. That's the bad things that happen to us. But before we get there, we have the evil of guilt. malum culpe. Now, let's just say you're getting to that, into your car and you're heading west and you just say, I hate traffic cameras and I really don't like stupid traffic laws and I'm going to do the speed I want. Then if you do that, you're guilty. You're properly culpable of speeding, especially if there are little kids playing on the side of the street. Now, notice that culpa is an interesting word here. It's worth spending just a little bit of time talking about. I know I'm running out, but I'll stop soon. 10 minutes, okay. Notice that if we talk about culpability, we're talking about guilt. Now, notice that if you can think back to third grade and you've got an arithmetic class exam right in front of you, a test, and you get a few of them wrong, notice that you might not be happy with yourself afterwards, but you're not going to go running off to confession. You're not going to be worried about getting smited by God or smoked by God, because what you've done on that arithmetic test is made an honest mistake. That could be described as a fault. But notice that some actions are not accurately described as faults. If you can imagine something that happens not all that rarely in any one of our cities, certainly not this one here. Somebody goes into a bank and robs it and is confronted by a police officer on the way out and shoots him. The guy's dead. And then he gets arrested. And he's looking at a really long sentence. And he gets up and tells the judge at his arraignment, I made a mistake. I needed money. I just made a mistake. I wasn't thinking clearly at the time. Now notice that that's not quite the same thing as getting a few questions wrong on an arithmetic test. Why? Because he has killed another human being. And that's what we call culpability. He has acted badly. Now, it's helpful to think about these two different kinds of evil, the evil that we do and the evil that we suffer. Augustine and Aquinas both were aware that the evil that we suffer is derivative from the evil that we do, either personally or more generally, universally. Aquinas has, in some places, an account of how original sin shows itself in our society and in our own lives. Notice we can see it in our own lives to the extent that we're not immortal and that we get sick and eventually we die, but also by the misfortunes that we encounter in our lives, the car accidents that we may or may not be involved in, the loss of loved ones, and so forth, all of the misfortunes that happen to any person in this world. Now, for Aquinas, all of this is a consequence of original sin. The world that we have inherited is in a very serious way broken down. It's right there in the creation narratives of Genesis. Now, it's not an easy thing to talk about because it's all too easy for people to blame other people for moral failings in view of certain misfortunes that may have happened to them. So somebody is in a plane that crashes, either over the Potomac, not far from here, or anywhere else, maybe in Philadelphia. And it's all too easy to suppose that these people were somehow responsible for this misfortune. God must have had it out for this or that person. And so forth. Some stand-up comedians have even been saying this about the wildfires that burned up so much of Los Angeles. You know, God must have really had it out for these people. Now notice that in a certain large sense, it's true that all the bad things that happen in the world are derivative of sin. But it's not true that they're derivative exclusively from our own personal sins. They can derive from the sins of other people, but most especially from original sin. Now, it's worth keeping in mind that if we're talking about original sin, that way in which this moral failure on the part of people who lived at the beginning affects us, it's also true that the solution to evil affects us, every single one of us. About that more tomorrow. Any questions, conundrums, problems, or paradoxes?
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.